Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, Heritage Radio Network podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We do more varieties and flavors of cheese than anywhere else on Earth. By pushing the boundaries of what cheese can and should be, find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Grant Reynolds. We'll talk to Grant about his new book, The Wine List, Parcel, Wine, and more. I asked Grant to pull a bottle out to taste. We'll do that towards the end of the show for the weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Hailing from Lake Placid, New York, Grant Reynolds realized it was easier to pursue a career in wine than ski jumping. After college in Boulder, he wound up in the greatest wine incubator at Bobby Stuckey's Frasca. He went on to work in Burgundy, Piedmont, Noma, before settling in New York to open Charlie Bird as wine director and partner, later opening Parcel Wine, with a few things in between. Grant is the true entrepreneur and believer of wine and e-commerce. He recently opened a new restaurant near Parcel called Tolo. Besides being an awarded sommelier, Grant recently published his second book, The Wine List, Stories and Tasting Notes Behind the World's Most Remarkable Bottles. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Grant.
Thank you. Thank
was
you
that? Was
you
that?
Nailed it.
I nailed it.
That
all
felt
right.
Good. Yeah.
All right. So we're talking to Grant at Parcel, which is downtown, and this is Chinatown, right?
This is Chinatown. According to the city, it is Chinatown.
So we're in Chinatown. We're sitting in the bar. Obviously, it's not open. All right. Let's get right into it. So you grew up in Lake Placid, and you headed to Boulder to college, right?
To college. Yeah.
Did you go there to ski?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I grew up Lake Placid. I always say this to give some perspective. Lake Placid had all 4 years of high school, our basketball team lost every single game because it was a winter sport. And so if you're remotely athletic, you played hockey or skied. So coming out of the public school in Lake Placid, skiing was sort of my only pursuit in life, which led me to Boulder, to CU Boulder, to try to keep the ski thing going, which quickly ended and
why
left me in restaurants. I think skiing still today, even more so, it's a very much a young person's sport. And I think
is that
by the time you hit like 18 or 19, you kind of know whether there's probably now by the time you hit 13 or 14, you know whether there's a professional future for you. And I just didn't.
So in Lake
I didn't
Placid,
quite have it, but
in Lake Placid, everyone vicariously thinks they're going to become some kind of pro or something.
Oh yeah.
And if you're
sure.
not
yeah,
that kid
sure.
pulled out in eighth grade,
yeah,
you're
yeah.
probably done by high
yeah,
school.
Yeah. It's probably
okay.
dumb. So that's that. But I chose wisely and was lucky to end up in a really beautiful city like Boulder that not only had good access to skiing, but also at the time a really exciting restaurant and farm and also CPG, just sort of all things food culture that was going on at the time. So I really, that was an
so
easy transition.
My oldest kid was there probably a couple of years after you.
Okay.
You know, so very familiar.
Yeah.
Literally, you know, with what you were experiencing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, from the food culture to Frasca, which was an oasis and all that, which I want to talk about.
Yeah.
So you were there for college, probably going your late teens. You know, you come out 20, early 20s. You hung around.
Yeah, so I started working.
You start at Frasca at a young age, or you did?
I did. So I started at Frasca right before I turned 21, and I worked at another restaurant in Boulder called The Kitchen that actually had a really strong education program.
That was about, a Musk, was it?
The Kitchen. It is, yeah.
Kimball, right?
Kimball and this his partner Hugo, who is a really just exceptional chef from the River Cafe. And you know, before that, living in Lake Placid, I worked in restaurants my whole life. I have lovely places that are all still open today, but didn't necessarily have a wine culture to them. There's now just starting to be a little bit of a, you know, greater wine culture up in Lake Placid, but
I'm surprised demand didn't push it, you know, because a lot of money goes up there.
Yeah, there's actually a hotel I worked at while in high school, an original Relais Chateau hotel called the Lake Placid Lodge. They also have The Point. They're very much sort of the inspiration.
Crazy places.
Crazy
the Point's place. Crazy.
Yeah, that Blackberry Farm took. You know, they were kind of early pioneers of
great hotels. Are you saying what The Point was doing, Blackberry Farm took that as their inspiration?
Absolutely.
Okay,
yeah. I didn't realize Bell, you know, rest in peace.
Yeah.
I met him at Frasca, and he told me those words, so I feel as if I can recite them.
Wow.
But so there, I didn't know at the time, but have gone back and sort of picked through the old Lake Placid Lodge wine list, which had some good cherries on it over the years. So,
all right, so we graduated college. We're not skiing as much. We take a job in our early 20s at Frasca.
Yeah.
Take me on a chronological line without much detail, because we'll talk about detail, from Frasca to here.
To here, yeah. So Frasca, you know, I met Bobby and his wife while I was working at The Kitchen. I think, you know, at the time, a guy named Richard Betts was in Boulder too. Bobby, Richard, also a guy named Brett Zimmerman. All master sommeliers, and frankly, were just easy people to look up to.
Richard at Frasca?
No, Richard wasn't at Frasca. Richard had just moved from Aspen to Boulder, and he was starting Sombra. So he wasn't at a restaurant
in Boulder. Sombra was in Boulder.
Yep, I think he probably started it while at the Nell still, but he had, you know, sort of started some projects.
Right.
Richard, I'll give credit, is, you know, one of the most creative entrepreneurs, I think, in the wine industry, and a wonderful guy. He was really kind to me early on. But those guys, I was like, oh, cool. There's, you know, these, frankly, just good people to be around who are into this wine thing and easy shoes to follow. And that led me to getting a job at Frasca, which I think Bobby gave me a chance at a pretty early age, because I speak Italian. I did a study abroad program in Italy in high school, which kind of, you know, was my in at Frasca without having any necessarily wine experience. And Frasca, I was there for a few years, did everything, leaving there as a sommelier, working with a guy named Matthew Mather, who is just one of the smart, great wine minds and hospitable and service and everything, just a wonderful person. But I knew I wanted to get out of Boulder. One of the great things about Frasca, not only, you know, from a education standpoint, it was sort of a revolving door of people from other markets coming there. So I feel really fortunate. In a couple of days, I'm going to do a dinner at Quince in San Francisco. I first met Mike Tusk at Frasca. Now best friend and partner in Charlie Bird, Robert Bohr, I met at Frasca. There was all these connections that came out of Frasca, which made it really easy for me to go other places and, you know, have a foot in the door, so to speak. So I left Frasca. I, you know, was 24 at the time, and I worked at Domaine Dujac, just picking grapes for a few weeks, which was really fun. That was 2012, a rainy, wet, quick harvest, but a really wonderful experience, and made some great friends while there, Jeremy and Diana and the whole SES team, but also some other people were there
hooked,
too.
Who hooked that up for you?
That probably came through Bobby, yeah, okay. and you know, just on email with Jeremy. And then while there, I sent like a cold email to Noma, just saying, you know, I had done it before. I did a study abroad in Rome and worked at Roscioli, and sort of my pitch was like, you know, you don't have to pay me.
Like a stage.
But exactly. And but you know, I wanna work. If you can pay me, great. But essentially, like, feed me and let me taste some wine and do it. So I did that at Roscioli for a couple months one summer, and that was sort of, you know, my pitch to Noma. And I ended up being at Noma for a little over 2-3 months, wow, probably. So had a really great experience there.
How far along were they? How long were they open?
I mean, they were in the old space.
A few years or more?
Yeah, a few years for sure. They had already won Best Restaurant.
And they didn't pay you because they were notorious for not paying people.
No, they were super generous with
me.
I got to say, yeah, I have nothing. I was very much like there for my, I don't think I added anything to the experience of Noma other than maybe being a body on the floor, filling up water and pouring coffee. But it really, you know, the wine director at the time, Moss, was, you know, I came from, at that point, a very traditional wine background. Bobby, you know, being adventurous in the regions he represents. But at the time, natural wine hadn't really, I think, matured to the point, both in terms of what was accessible here in the U.S. So there's definitely like a lot of stigma around it. And I feel like my time at Noma, really just asking Mas questions and his palate, it gave me a perspective of natural wine to where it wasn't all just like flawed, messed up wine, but really I think they were totally on the cutting edge of really doing the work of understanding the producers who you would qualify as natural producers, but, you know, weren't necessarily natural just for the title of it, but really philosophically.
And
doing
that was years ago.
That was
where
a long
the
time
understanding
ago.
And acceptance is different than now.
Yeah, it's much different.
And
now.
Quality.
And quality. I think, you know, producers.
Was it a natural, pretty much only wine list?
Oh, fully. I remember he had like 3 bottles of Dom Perignon 96 Rosé. In the cellar that he refused to put on the wine list. it was really at that point had converted to be fully natural. And frankly, those wines really made sense with the food at the time, which was, you know, at that point they were full on into Nordic ingredients and
foraging
cuisines.
And
exactly. But so that was that. That was just a fun short stint. I thought about staying there. But I was broke and like really, really broke. And, my family's from New York, my dad. And so I came back around the holidays, there was a closure and, through Bobby had, connected with Robert, ran into Robert Dujac, et cetera, and just said, hey, I'm in New York. And at the time, Robert very much was, and who I got to know later, Ned Benedict, rest in peace. For me, they were the connectors of many, many restaurants to wine directors and to sommeliers. Meaning, I feel like they were
both two restaurants. I mean,
they weren't in restaurants at the time.
No, but did Ned work at like Boulet?
Yeah, exactly.
And,
so
Robert,
I think
was at Veritas.
Many, many people got the jobs that they got through Ned and Robert saying, hey, this is a good person and do it. So I knew he was the guy to call. And at the time I was interviewing in at restaurants that weren't like Charlie Bird. So the three places were, at the time, Per Se, Danielle, and 11 Madison Park. And Robert, you know, said, hey, this is a totally different direction, but the I'm opening up a restaurant, and we'll be open in a few months. If you want to, you know, help me do that, then that opportunity is there for you. I'll keep you busy in the meantime. And I had become really close, and still am, with Rajat Parr, who I knew he was in Boulder a lot at the time, doing different wine dinners, and he's just a, you know, an old friend of Bobby's. So I got to know him, and he was really someone who I really confided in terms of, hey, what should I do? I just want to taste wine, et cetera. And he was like, cool, if you want to taste wine, you got to be in New York. And that's like, you just need to taste old wine. And the only place to really get access to old wine in America at the time was New York, San Francisco a little bit too at the point. But so I was like, okay, that's what you say. I'm going to, you know, New York's really easy for me to go to. And so I ended up in New York and was right place, right time.
Wait, Charlie was Raj Somming then, or he was beat?
RN 74 was still open.
Okay.
But Raj was doing both winemaking and,
right.
And RN was still open. But
so you come to Charlie
Bird. So I come to Charlie Bird. That's 2013 Charlie Bird open. And I have never left New York since, or what, 2024 now. So,
So you do Charlie Bird like head down hard.
Head down hard, yeah. We worked really worked hard.
You guys opened a few other places you get involved, so we went, or no?
Charlie Bird, and then we did Pasquale Jones, and then after that, we did a restaurant called Legacy Records.
Were you involved?
I was involved, yeah.
Okay.
So
was Arvid around then?
Arvid was. So Arvid really came over from Europe. Robert is a very convincing person, but he, Arvid came. He worked with us at Charlie Bird for a little while, and the idea was that he would come and be our partner and really oversee Legacy Records. And, of course, giant restaurants take time, so he ended up being at Charlie Bird for a little bit longer. The fact that he won best sommelier in the world while sommelier at Charlie Bird still cracks me up. Charlie Bird cannot take any credit for his hard work, because he had done all of that before he showed up. But I think it was a good, you know, a very fun, easy place to work, and you know, back then a lot of great wine was rolling through the door. So Arvid. And then
when does so you get Legacy open?
So you get Legacy
this
open,
big, you know, space,
giant space. Yeah,
but there's also a retail store,
exactly
by the same name of where we're sitting. How that come about?
Yeah, so Legacy is in a new building,
way west in the way in Midtown. West
38th. I drove by it today, dropping my car off to be serviced, and. In this huge, call it 15,000 square foot development that we are a part of, it's much, you know, much, much larger building, but we had two floors that we were really a part of, both in terms of, and, you know, we worked on it for years before it opened. The idea was there was, you know, sort of activations from a food and beverage standpoint throughout this whole space. But there was this one little corner that they had blocked off for an independent retail lease. And so, we said, hey, I'll take that and try to get a retail license. It's a tiny space. It's 200 square feet.
You need retail and liquor license, or they're the same?
Retail license is what allows people to come in and take a bottle and leave from it.
From a restaurant or in general?
No, from a wine shop, liquor shop, okay. Et cetera. It's really hard to acquire a new one. And so our concession was that we're only serving wine. We're only going to sell wine. And that was a pretty easy case for us to make, given our background. And so we got a retail license there. And through Ned, met Christine Collado, who still works with us.
She's been on the
today.
Show.
So she was very much the
Wait, she still works with you?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I thought she's out in... No, she's in Brooklyn, right?
She lives in Brooklyn. Yeah, yeah. She's here. I was on the phone with her. First thing Monday morning. Yeah.
She's been on the show.
My first phone call. She's the best. But she, through Ned, actually, she was leaving Brooklyn Fair and looking to do something not in restaurants. And so she came on to help us open up Parcel. And because it was such a small space, our vision from day one was always to be a primary delivery service. I had no idea like what it would take to do that and how hard it would be to get it going. But we started that, and that was, and we really, really got the ball rolling in call it, you know, January 2019. And then, you know, at the time.
Wait, you said delivery? You looked at it as a place to build up, to shoot wine out, than to rely on walk-in.
Exactly.
And I mentioned in the intro, you know, e-commerce is something you embraced. Was that part of the...
Yeah, it was a big part of it. And the reason was, you know, the neighborhood's still today really challenging from a foot traffic standpoint. And so we knew that, hey, we're, you know, let's sort of bring the wine to people, which very much existed. You know, wine shops have been delivering, but we knew that we had to build a, you know, a business model that was the primary source for.
So what is that? Is it an online site?
Yeah.
Is it capturing email?
So it's online site.
I mean,
site.
How are you?
It's a lot of, you know, email marketing, a lot of one-to-one sales. So a regular who we know what they like and they can hit us up. And but it really started out as a website. So the idea was website. We had a very early partnership with Caviar, which we no longer have, but we were very much their sort of pilot for alcohol delivery. And then they got acquired and we got kicked to the side. Thank you, Square. But the idea of it was to be an e-commerce, you know, delivery wine service.
So when you say delivery, you were talking about servicing that kind of interesting, tough residential neighborhood.
Although we were ambitious.
Hudson Yards.
Yeah, exactly. We were ambitious. We wanted to service a lot of places, so the van would go out
across town.
Exactly, and you know, we had a whole bunch of ideas in terms of how to get wine to people on demand, so to speak. But now we ship and deliver almost everywhere nationally, and it is, it's been going great.
So a couple of interesting things to me about that. It's a small place. Obviously, you're curating, you know, a very specific selection.
Yeah.
Are you providing your customers with access to stuff that other people weren't getting? You know, Robert has... Or Grand Cru has connections, you know, or clients and a lot of people.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, we buy from all the wholesalers. We buy from, you know, because I think it started out as a small space. Again, we were like kind of really trying to lean into not having everything for everyone, but having almost like a wine list approach of, hey, here's our sort of seasonal selection of what we do have, and this is what we're excited about. And so we still do that. You know, we definitely have a point of view. We don't have anything and everything and all the wines that maybe a traditional retailer might have.
But you don't have to, and you can't.
Yeah, you don't have to, I think. And that's just our, you know, that's what we do.
So the business primarily is shipping online?
Shipping online, yeah. And, you know, I think we were really
fortunate.
All over
the country now?
All over the country. We were really fortunate when COVID did happen to have the delivery infrastructure and have a website.
It was up and running by
We were already up and running. We had a team. We were ready to go. So,
did winemakers, like not specifically, but take a guy like Raj Parr who's making wine or something. He says, listen, no restaurants are buying, you know, can we push some of this in? And did that happen? Or
I mean, I think my understanding is that there was sort of a there's of course this terrible time of which nobody knew what was going on, right? And I think, you know, at the end of the day, the majority of winemakers would rather see their wine in a restaurant than their wine on a retail shelf. Why? Because a restaurant, you have, in theory, somebody representing it, and it's being serviced well, and all these things, right? But there's also just a very long-standing tradition of winemakers to restaurants. So I think what happened is retail really took off. Restaurants obviously quieted down. And I think there, you know, from what my understanding is, and I don't have any like data to back this up, is that it was a pretty even balance for winemakers, for wholesalers, to really be able to keep depletions going in the same way that they had before. I think right. Probably not for everyone,
right.
But I think for the right people, more people were drinking at home during COVID, et cetera. Now that has kind of course corrected itself, right? And restaurants, thank God.
In New York, the openings in the last 2 years are nuts, right? Yeah, the
openings.
Which is nice.
It's great. It's great. It's really, really great. And I think, you know, also many importers have really done great work in terms of supporting producers and finding new producers and doing all that. And we're, you know, really at the mercy of them being on the ground and finding new products to introduce us to, that we then, you know, sell to consumers.
I agree with that. I mean, we're not going to name people, but there's more than a handful of people that have been around and have emerged, you know, whether it's German wine.
Yeah, of course.
You know, natural and all that are really prominent now and important.
Yeah.
To those regions and to all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so let's finish the chronological line. You have Parcel. We have Parcel. The wine store. We're sitting in Parcel, the wine bar. Yeah, exactly. Bar.
So I, you know, ended up leaving Delicious Hospitality Group in 2020, just deciding to try to focus my energy on one business, one thing.
Do you retain Parcel, the retail store?
I retain Parcel. It's I split that off and just focus on that. All right. So now we're in the summer of 2020.
Which is COVID summer.
Which is COVID summer, correct. We are super scrappy, trying new things, delivery in the Hamptons, blah, blah, blah. We're all over the place. But the business continues to, you know, and at this time, I think, you know, there was uncertainty with everybody, right? But the business continues to chug along and pretty excited about it. But I realized that, you know, at this point, we were totally digital for 6 months. And I felt like there was an opportunity for us, given my experience, given Christine's experience too, to try to do something that is a brick and mortar version of what we want Parcel to be. So we ended up renting this space essentially as a pop-up. And that was, you know, August, early September of 2020, which was an incredible time to be in New York. I'll say the energy was amazing and supportive and happy. And it was just a really special time to be here. We did this pop-up. We called it Parcel. And our whole thing was, hey, you know what? You, in a wine shop, legally, you can't serve wines by the glass. You can't really serve food. You can't do all these things, right? And so I was like, hey, you know what? We really believe wholeheartedly that the best introduction to wine for consumers is in the form of a restaurant. As sommeliers, I think it's the most authentic experience for them to have versus like reading an email, although we write a lot of emails. We think it's important versus things. Reading a book, whatever. But the experience of being well taken care of, sitting down in a restaurant, having a special time with the person across the table from you and having a great glass of wine, I just believe that cements the quality of wine for people.
Agreed. Was the pop-up here or another location?
No, the pop-up was on Hudson Street.
Okay.
So we did that, and then, you know, winter of 2020, 2021, COVID got super messy again. So we were lucky to be nimble in that. So we were like, you know what? We're not going to do this like indoor half occupancy thing. We don't need to. It's not really worth our while. We're going to suspend the pop-up for a little while. We did that. And then at that time, it really helped us. Hey, let's like, now COVID has chilled out a little bit. We have a better sense of the business. Let's really focus back on the e-commerce business and see where we're going with that, while looking at spaces to do a permanent version of Parcel where we're sitting today. We ended up renting an office from our current landlord here. He said, hey, it's might be a spot that'll work well for you. It's small. It's
reasonable.
Reasonable. you can't have full gas though. It can't be a full restaurant. There's limitations, et cetera, et cetera. And we saw the space. We said, this is great. Let's do it. And,
what year was that?
That was towards the end of 2021.
Okay.
And, then we took the space over.
Do you open in 21 or we you opened had in to 22. Wait till 22, right?
We opened in 22. So we opened in July of 2022 as the first Parcel Wine Bar, which is our version of a tasting room, our brick and mortar. It's a restaurant. It's really just a
So this is space. A good segue into sure. this. I figured you'd be a good guy. There's definitely a cool phenomenon going on in New York. And even the rest of the country now, kind of a new generation of wine bars.
Yeah.
If you look in New York, there's places like Claude and Four Horsemen.
Yep.
Newer places, the Wild Air guys just opened Demo.
Yeah.
Flynn, Gem Wine.
Yeah.
And you, they have incredible wine. I mean, you talked about really what the vision is and incredible food.
Yeah.
So here's where I'm torn. I mean, is this a wine bar? Is it a restaurant?
Yeah,
I know essentially it's both. But I mean, I think when the Four Horsemen opened, they didn't get the notices for food they're getting now.
Yeah.
And I think the kid from Gem was a cook and now he's shifting towards wine and food.
Yeah.
What are you doing here and what do you think?
Yeah, those are all some of my favorite spots. Across the board, and I think the reason is that it's really good food and there's good wine lists in a setting that is not formal, right? So if that's what differentiates a wine bar from a restaurant, I'm all for it. Now, I would say
I think of everything we mentioned, there's no major formality,
all,
right?
Yeah, I think of them all as frankly restaurants more so than wine bars, but I think the notion of the wine bar is important for, and I will say all of us in that group, because you want people to come here knowing that it is a place to drink wine. And I think most restaurants today, still, there's wine is a part of a larger beverage program, right? Now you can get a good cocktail at Claude, at Four Horsemen, I'm not sure, at Gem, but the idea of this sort of wine bar restaurant thing is, I think we really struggle with it. And people are like, so what is it? It's like, it's a wine bar, but it's really a restaurant. And that is, because like saying a tasting room, then it feels sort of too educational. But at the end of the day, we designed the space. You'll see there's tables that are at dining height that are really easy to have dinner at. And then there's tables
We're sitting at a big table. There's four tops. There's low chairs. And
then there's low chairs that are a little bit
wrap-around lounge. But on a given night, whatever time you pick, you know, a 8, 9 is the sweet spot. How many people are sitting there just drinking, you know, by the glass or bottles, and how many people are eating and drinking?
It's about 50-50.
So people and are drinking and people are...
And I think by calling ourselves a wine bar, it allows people to have that experience, and that's what we want.
But right? They're like coming in and ripping a few good bottles because they know it's happening.
Yeah. They come in and, you know, have a good bottle of wine and hang out. But I think, you know, there's this sort of unspoken contract between customers and restaurants. And you come in and you have 90 minutes to 2 hours and you got to order a couple courses and you got to order wine. But the primary service of that space is food and dining, right?
So take a place like Company. You know, it's not much different than this. The kitchen may even be smaller. I don't know.
I mean,
is the food there as a revenue point? Is it there to complement the wine? Is it to make it, you know, full circle the experience?
You know, I originally didn't want to do any food here. We wanted and then it evolved into like snacks, and I was like, all right.
You got it.
And then we have a, you know, totally a full menu. So I think it's, you know, people will come more frequently if you can have dinner. For us, our ideal experience is somebody, you know, walks in, has a glass of wine, is enjoying themselves, and is like, hey, can I stick around for dinner too?
Order food. And more wine.
And more wine and go from there. So I think that's it. And I think it's good.
It's a great scene, and there's incredible people doing it.
Thank you.
Grant, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're talking to Grant Reynolds. Grant is the proprietor of Parcel, the wine store, Parcel, the restaurant. When we come back, we're going to talk about his new book, The Wine List. So we'll be right back. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin, the state of cheese, makes half of the nation's specialty cheese and wins more awards than any other state or country. Our heritage and traditions, master cheesemaker program, and the American propensity for innovation all put Wisconsin on the cutting wedge of cheesemaking. With over 600 varieties of cheese to choose from and 5,500 national and international awards and counting, get ready to turn your refrigerator into a trophy case. Enjoying a Wisconsin cheese is basically like winning a gold medal in culinary achievement. Set your mind at cheese. When you bite into a wedge of Wisconsin Wonderful, you know it is made with the ultimate skill and passion possible. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Grant Reynolds. Grant, let's talk about the book.
Let's talk about the book.
Ironically, this is your second book. Your first being How to Drink Wine. You co-wrote it with Chris Stang.
Yeah.
Chris Stang, prolific guy, co-founder of Infatuation. Your new book, which I want to talk to you about, is The Wine List. I read you the whole long name at the intro and all that. So to me, it seems like you like to write. I mean, you've written two books in not a long period of time in between.
Yeah.
You know, it's time consuming. It takes you away from certain things. What is it about, you know, all this nonsense that you have to keep on? What is it about writing and writing about wine?
I think, you know, for me, in writing The Wine List, it was also a way for me to continue reading and researching about wine for myself, which I really enjoyed. Right. So,
at a different.
Yeah. Just looking into older books and, you know, connecting the dots in a way that I, you know,
so you jump in and say, I'm writing a book. Now you do what you have to. So that gives you a discipline to fulfill your
interests. And I think, you know, I was doing it. I wrote it on the weekend, for a prolonged period of time.
How long?
My editor listens to this. She'll not in agreement that I was very late in the delivery of this book. But
how late is late? A year?
I don't know. Probably it was a while.
More than a year?
No, not more than a year. Definitely not more than a year. Right. Definitely not more than a year. There was also, you know, to my credit, a very compressed timeline. But the idea, I just like writing.
So let's get the vitals out of the way.
Yeah.
Finish that sentence. Sure. But, you know, when and why did you decide to write the book?
Yeah.
After writing another one.
After that.
But you said you like writing.
I like writing. I like doing, just having a hobby, doing something creative that is not the restaurant or e-commerce. Just, it's felt like something that I frankly just, it didn't feel like a chore, but as much as
is that
time well spent.
You're so consumed with this that you don't really have other hobbies that you make that a hobby?
No, I definitely have other hobbies, but I'm not a scratch golfer,
I'm guessing.
No, I'm not a scratch golfer. Definitely not. But the, I wish I, you know, kept up with golf, but I didn't have it in me. But the, truthfully, I just like writing. I really like the process of it. I like art. I like design. And so for me, it's a way to try to bring it all together and learn about it and connect with people professionally that otherwise I wouldn't have had the connection to, through publishers, through artists, through researchers, a woman named Becky Cooper, who's a really good friend. She wrote We Keep the Dead Close. She's one of the smartest people I know. She wrote a chunk of the book as well.
We'll talk
timelines,
about the
format, etc. But I think for me, it was like, hey, if I have the opportunity presented to me to do something like this, I would.
So when
I would
did
like
you decide and why this type of book?
So this book, part of what I've always loved about wine is beyond the very technical points of winemaking. I really believe there are stories that are either personal to a winemaker or specific to a period of time, or, you know, relate to a larger cultural shift that I've always found really interesting. And as early as I've been into wine, I've always, I think maybe because I got into it at such a young age and I was really, really lucky to have access to older wines, I had this habit of trying to understand what else was going on in the world during that year. So both from a weather perspective, to understand, hey, somebody says this is a good vintage. What is that really? Why? Is it just from taste? But what happened to make it, you know, be a good or bad or, you know, terrible vintage? So doing that research was just something that I always really connected with most. And then,
well, you open the book,
yeah,
isolating or talking specifically about the word vintage,
yeah,
and that sort of sets the table, you know, for where you're going. You
definitely,
you say, and you were getting into it. I want you to get into more. It's sort of like a time capsule,
yeah.
You know, so you're drinking this cool wine at Frasca, and you're like, okay, this is a cool wine. I need to know more.
Exactly.
So now you get into the vintage, which is climate, you know,
everything.
Go ahead.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's also a lot of oral history around wines, and whether that's, you know, chatter at a table or amongst sommeliers about producers or very specific vineyards within a certain vintage that are better than another one for this reason or that have also always been really interesting to me. And I thought that, you know what, maybe I'll try to compile some of the stories around vintages, around producers, around movements in wine that I have tried to make sense of. Right. And a lot of that is frankly the inception or the beginning of a certain property or winemaker, and then, you know, documenting their influence, because I think how these people come about is important and really sets the stage for where they go. And then I also think, you know, there's been certain bottles that are notorious. There's been certain vintages that are just so exceptional that, you know, we think of a year and it's just great across everywhere. And why is that? That I found like, hey, you know what? There's a lot of questions that I get asked from customers in the restaurant that I feel like maybe in the form of a book are, you know, just easier to go in deeper with.
You know, if anyone's into wine and they hear that, they go, I'd love to get, you know, that perspective and all that. What you said sounds a little random relative to what the book is, which is very disciplined in the sense of vintages. I mean, you start at a timeline.
Yeah.
And you take us, you know, pretty much to current time.
Yeah.
I mean, when did you decide that, you know, I have all these sort of oral anecdotes I've read about stuff, you know, I've met people I've drank.
I mean, that's...
You know, let me structure it this way. So answer that and explain to people, you know, how you have the book formatted.
Definitely. So I think, you know, for me, there's, in learning about wine, right, there's definitely knowledge to be gained from reading the book, but it's not intended to be a kind of wine 101, like teach all if you know nothing about wine. The How to Drink that I wrote with Chris is
more
that.
So I said to you offline, I said, this to me is not a how to drink or a what to drink wine.
No.
You know, it's more steeped into vintage, the stories around a culture.
Yeah, exactly. And I was hoping that, you know, you also don't need to know technical information to appreciate
nerdy
crap. History of a certain bottle, and so I really wanted to try to use language and insights to where you could ideally read a story and maybe know nothing about wine and find the story itself an interesting story, right? And
so talk about the setup.
Yeah, so the setup.
The chronology, the stories you're talking about are not long-winded.
They're brief.
You've picked a lot of things, and I want to ask you how you picked those. You talk about them, but you do it in a chronologic way.
Sure. So
A sidebar, which I want to mention.
Exactly. So I think the chronological part of it is, you know, it's not every single year, right? I didn't feel like that was necessary, nor would I, you know, be the authority to speak on bad vintages of the 20s. But the thing that I kind of came to terms with, it's like started out with a few stories that I knew I wanted to include. And then I was like, okay, so these are in different years. There's a bit of foundation in terms of how those wines have succeeded that I believe is necessary.
What were the early things buzzing around your head?
The early things buzzing around were and this was part of pitch to the editor, was the very tragic story of Soldera's wines getting poured out with the 2006 vintage being the last that he fully bottled as Brunello. That was an early one. The where we've come with grower champagne
was want to talk to you about.
These
are stories that resonated.
One. These are stories that resonated with me, and then trying to understand, you know, I found people saying like, "Oh, this is a grower champagne," and seeing like blank faces on most consumers being like, "Cool, I don't really know what that means. Why does that matter to me?" Right? And who started that, and where did that really become, and what is it? So I think, you know, it made sense to, hey, let's like go back a little bit and talk about, you know, how that happened. And then also, you know, the story has been told so many times, but I do think for, you know, a larger audience, stories around bottlings during the war for me have always been really captivating. And I think, you know, World War II really represented a huge shift for agriculture and technology, and of course, you know, its impact on
1945.
And you know, through that all, I think for me, there's a very like clear line of wine before and after that, and I think, you know, I wanted to dive into that a little bit deeper, but so it felt like I can't start talking about today without referencing the past. And because it does relate, hey, you know, you can't talk about Gros Champagne if you don't at least give a nod and mention to, all right, it's a reaction from what, right? It's a reaction from these larger houses.
Let's get into sections and chapters. Sure. Let's talk about Champagne because, okay, you know, I want to get specific about that.
Yeah, yeah.
So the Champagne chapter section or whatever is very specific to a few things which you were just going to talk about.
Yeah.
A maker, the movement, the influence.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
so definitely. Talk to me about, you know, all of those things.
Yeah, I mean, we speak about Dom Pérignon and Salon and you know, the blue chip collectibles.
Houses, right?
Houses, yeah. That, you know, started out small in their day too. And then I think, you know, I remember, and it still happens, for a long time, every new grower champagne that I would get introduced to, it felt like there was some nod to Solos, whether they interned at Solos, worked with Solos.
You have to go back. You have to do two things. You have to talk about when Solos came on the scene, about what year was that? Mid-late 80s.
Yep.
Kind of what he did.
Yeah.
You know, who he influenced.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is where you are now, but I need you to go backwards.
Okay, sure. So I think, you know, to get there is I was like, okay, so Solos, I really believe in a lot of ways, has influenced this huge generation of grower champagne, right? And who all now have their own successes, right? But Solos being, you know, the one to really devote himself to the craft of grower champagne, meaning, of course, farming and producing it yourself.
Versus a house pulling in from different...
Versus a house buying wine, stuff, buying right. grapes, et cetera, right. et cetera. Right? And giving the platform for, you know, these smaller winemakers to be able to sell their product directly to restaurants rather than to the big houses.
Was that a big risk for him to do that?
Yeah, it was a big risk in that nobody really cared, right? And the sales, you know, nowadays it's really... It's much easier to be public if you're in, you know, a relatively remote part of France on an international scale than it was back in the 80s, right? So I think it was a huge risk, but he did it, you know, for the purposes of craft and quality and his vision. And of course, there's technical influence that Solos had in terms of winemaking style, in terms of farming that was then learned by others that I believe... You know, not all grower champagne tastes like Solos. Absolutely not. Still,
say why? Because
a very singular wine.
It's oxidative, or how do you describe it?
I think yes, the nutty oxidative style of Solos is very specific. There's also, you know, if you have older Solos, it's not as oxidative as you know the wine, and also you know some of the single vineyards and stuff that they put out now aren't substance, et cetera. So I feel like the oxidative style isn't something I crave all the time. However, it is definitely an exceptional
it has a
product.
Place.
It has a place. I do feel like we look at Solos just through that lens, whereas he was and still is a really exceptional winemaker beyond that style as well. And I really do believe that. But... you know, that then he really started the snowball for other people to be able to say, hey, you know what? I want to do that too. And now that has led us to this, frankly, huge time to where there's so much champagne and so many different producers and so many different styles and so much experimentation, which I believe champagne really allows producers to experiment inherently through its process. It's not necessarily about just purity and the expression of something. There's, you know, a timeline to it that is specific and a process to it that inherently requires the winemaker to make decisions that, you know, you don't have to make and still win.
Right.
So I think, yeah, that you know, for me, it was like backtracking. Hey, right now we're in this explosive moment of champagne, to where you go to many restaurants and you don't see the big names anymore. Why is that? And how did that happen? Chronologically speaking, going back to, all right, cool, this is how it happened. Right, this was, let's give credit to someone if we must, for being the first person to at least really do it with a lot of success. And then that, you know, has led us to a point now to where we have, of course, really exceptional champagne.
So there's three general blending grapes in champagne: Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier.
Meunier, yeah.
You talk about it later in the book.
Yeah.
How, you know, I'm pretty sure it wasn't used as much and there wasn't a lot of Pinot Meunier only champagnes. Yeah, yeah. How has that changed?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I do believe this is one of the first books to talk about really old school Bordeaux and the foundation of that, to addressing what's also going on today in terms of just common trends that you find in wine lists internationally in pretty wine specific restaurants. And Pinot Meunier nowadays is very well represented. One producer in particular, Prévost, who is, you know, connected to Solos as well, is can give it a lot of credit because it's just so exceptionally talented, made a wine just using Pinot Meunier. And that to now, I think you have people requesting it, seeing it, being much more familiar with it than it ever happened before. And I think that's an interesting notion, right? But we also have to look at, hey, cool, how did that happen, right? To where it now leads us to it, and who can we give some credit to really doing that? Because I think there's probably people, consumers out there, they're like, I didn't know that Pinot Meunier was an obscure champagne grape once upon a time. If you just got into it. And that's like a bit of my experience, frankly, was I started to get into wine when, you know, I remember going to a tasting where Terry Theis was there doing the road show with Grower Champagne. So for me, I had Grower Champagne before I had the great classic champagnes, right? So I also have to look at my experience. Hey, there's now a whole new generation of sommeliers who don't have access to wines that I had access to, and I didn't have access to wines that other people had access to, right? And that's okay. That's just our reality. But how do we, you know, maybe like connect the dots of, hey, these are the shoulders that some of the trends of today are really standing on. And I thought that's the goal of this book. That's the goal of the wine list. It's to give us a little bit of context. Yeah, you might see Grower Champagne, you might see orange wine, you might see these producers of Burgundy that are new and in a different price
point. Let's talk about
how did that happen. Yeah.
So to stay on trend, as far as a trend, orange wine has been a thing for a little bit now.
Sure.
There are some guys that, you know, for 30, 40 years have devoted their craft, guys like Grosvenor.
Mm-hmm.
And again, to your point, people may not have
no idea who Grosvenor is.
Grosvenor, yeah, yeah. Or what region it sort of started, you know, in Italy on the border and all of that.
Yeah.
So that aside, the wine is still resonating with people.
Why,
you know, why? How did that thing come out of?
Yeah, I think I've learned a lot about orange wine in the last 2 years from a consumer standpoint.
Talking, absorbing, listening?
Yeah, exactly. So my experience with orange wine was at Frasca, which is a restaurant based on Friuli, where Grosvenor, you know, Zitterich, et cetera, really came from, right? Grosvenor being, I think, the first to commercialize the style of orange wine again, right, in contemporary times, as it's a style that has been made for a very long time. He will tell you that as well. The amount of orange wine that, you know, to give some insight, when we first opened Charlie Bird, it was when the rosé boom was happening, right? And now I think within certain demographics, there's more orange wine being consumed than rosé, and it's being consumed in a similar way to rosé in terms of inexpensive, by the glass, just everyday drinking type product, right? And that is something that I didn't know up until a couple of years ago. We opened Parcel in a neighborhood that has a younger demographic within it. And orange wine last year was the wine we sold the most of by the glass. To give you an idea, at Charlie Bird, we sold almost no orange wine. That's how quickly it's changed and how quickly it's become popular. I'm for it, although I'm not one.
But it becomes popular because it's a thing, right? Not yeah, necessarily because of the history.
And I think
people understand that it's a skin con. You know, how did it get orange?
But listen, I'm of the mindset that natural wine, orange wine, whatever, right? If that is the gateway for people to then get into other wines, I'm all about it. Now, do I drink a ton of orange wine myself? No. Sometimes I would crave it if it's really hot outside and I'm having a certain type of food.
Are people drinking it all year round?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But the...
More than rosé?
Oh, yeah. It crushed rosé for us here. And I don't think that's happening everywhere,
right?
But it is happening. We just did a wine list at an airport lounge and we put a orange wine on there.
Killing it.
Well, I don't know. I don't know the depletions yet, but it was like, that would have never happened.
Oh, right.
The 5 years. But the fact that you're like, cool, we can,
yeah,
we probably should do this because there's so much demand for it. So yeah, I think my expectation isn't that everybody should know about Grosvenor if you're just having a glass of orange wine. But I do think if you look at it, you're like, cool, what? Like, how did this happen?
You took the time, which is a theme of the book.
Yeah, it's like, how did this happen and what started orange wine, right? Or, you know,
didn't the Sutters invent it in Napa when they left the white wine on the skins too long?
I don't know that
it's
story,
not a dissimilar story.
Okay.
People will kill me for bringing it up, but it's a stupid story why that pink Zinfandel or whatever came about.
Yeah. I guess that's true, yeah. Right, but I think... Yeah, that was it. And the reality is it's, I don't see it going anywhere anytime soon. No, maybe it'll certainly be a trend, but.
Is there a lot of crap out there?
Yeah, there's a ton of bad orange wine. I think for me, the biggest disclaimer on natural wine and a winemaker friend once said this, it's like, there are natural, quote unquote, wines that market themselves as natural wines out there that aren't farming organically, that probably have a whole bunch of sulfur. That are really just riding the wave. And I think it's dangerous.
Food is like that too. Yeah, they slap like natural on a bar.
Yeah, exactly. It's terrible. I think, there's a lot of stuff that tastes bad. And then there's also a lot of stuff that's just poorly made. But if you, do the work or go to the right spots, there's good wines.
Which you should for everything.
And I feel like that's our responsibility is to try to do that for consumers. And we don't scream about it, but we really try to do the work to make sure, hey, this isn't, just a white labeled nonsense garbage that otherwise would have gone in a slot machine Chardonnay.
Right.
Okay, so,
all right, let's go more traditional. Let's jump to Burgundy.
Sure.
As well as I do from your background, from writing the book, that Burgundy has become less accessible for some of the names we crave, extraordinarily expensive.
Yeah.
There's this whole, I don't know if elitism is the right word, whether it's these expensive dinners, fairs, auctions where the bottle prices are through the roof.
Yeah.
So the average guy ain't touching that.
Yeah.
But one of the nice things you do in the book, you talk a lot about traditional Burgundies.
Yeah, of course.
But tell me about the chapter where it's really focused on the new producers and what they're making, which kind of answers the accessibility or quality issue, that I initially brought up.
Yeah. No, I think it's a really exciting time in Burgundy. I was there. I try to go once a year. I was there this past fall, which, granted, I had a great trip, but it just, as a disclaimer, it's not the best time to go to Burgundy. But the...
Why?
It's just so busy, and winemakers
right.
are
you
like...
want more
they're just coming
you
off
want the
of
guys
harvest.
More
it,
relaxed.
Yeah, it just
right,
feels
right,
like a kind of a self-serving time to be there. Yeah. But the it's really beautiful and et cetera, but it's just, if you really want to like get into it, you should go when the weather's bad and nobody has anything to do.
Right.
But the there's this generation of largely younger winemakers. Some are winemakers who are, I believe, getting recognized within this generation, but maybe have been doing it in the sort of outskirts of the prime part of Burgundy for a long time. And I, you know, if I think about it in a way, we went for a long time, I was like, hey, what's the accessible version of Burgundy? It was Beaujolais, it was then the Jura, and now it's Burgundy, but other parts of Burgundy that people weren't making great wine in for
so
a long time.
So tick off some of the regions, like Mâconnais or...
Yeah, like Mâconnais, I think, in and around, you know, Morange is an area, Savigny-le-Bon, the Haute-Côte, Côte-Nuit, Village, you know...
A lot of the people you write about and talk about are...
Yeah, just certain vineyards within, you know, places that aren't... totally A-list, so younger people might have access to those grapes and to those contracts. I don't think most of them aren't necessarily buying land. Maybe they're buying a little plot here and there, but it's a pretty cool time for it.
Is this generational, like existing wine families, or these are new people getting into it, or a little of both?
I think it's strangely, it's a lot of like foreigners getting into it,
right.
It seems. But there's also some generational shifts as well that, you know, I think have happened lately. That's all to say is, like, I really believe the blue chip Burgundy producers of today, we can't be upset at them for the increase in prices across the board. It's not them.
They're
so
really
think,
farmers, these guys.
And I think it's the reality is like Burgundy is very different than most other wine regions in that it's super limited. We're talking about, you know, hundreds of bottles in certain instances, not tens of thousands, let alone hundreds of thousands of
like
bottles.
Bordeaux.
And so inherently, you know, there's just a supply issue. And if somebody really wants it, there's a natural, you know, effect to that, right? So I think where this has led us is, and I do believe that, like, there is a hierarchy of quality within Burgundy that should continue to be respected and is just definite in my mind. However, there are delicious wines who, you know, that frankly, some of them have also started to get really expensive, even if they're from pieces of land that aren't necessarily considered to be really expensive.
Right.
But there's really, really just exceptional wine that's being made in other parts of Burgundy as well. And we highlight a handful of those producers.
Right. It's one of the, not the few, but it's a section where you list.
Yeah.
You could walk away from that section and go, you know what? He recommended 8-9 people,
yeah.
You know, I can go and try it.
Yep.
As I mentioned, there's 65 plus sections in this. You know, we can't get to all of them. We described
no.
a lot of them. But let's touch on one last one, because you write about it. There's some redundancy in this topic in a good way, climate change and wine.
Oh, yeah.
It's hard for me to do a podcast, talk to winemakers or wine
yeah.
or writers, and not
yeah.
talk about climate change.
Yeah, of course.
So tell me about the significance. One of the ways you kind of launch it is a year that sort of epitomized this change, 2003.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Tell me, you know, why that and what happened. And then you talk about some of the specific things, specific effects that are, you know, that winemakers are experiencing and how some of them are adopting.
Yeah, definitely. For me, it's the most important and fascinating dilemma within the wine industry right now. I don't know. Nobody knows, right, where this will go, but it has had a huge, huge effect. 2003 is a really easy year to say, hey, this is when it really like smacked everybody in the face. It was an incredibly hot year there. At the time, it was the earliest harvest. Of course, since then, all of those records have been shattered, as is, you know, the trend outside of wine. And I think what we're starting to see already is the impact on flavor that climate change has had. So, you know, I was with a winemaker who we were tasting an old wine and got sort of emotional in that she was saying that, you know, this wine we'll never be able to make this wine again because of the climate. And that's a reality, right? And, you know, we're not going to change that. So I think we went to this place of, for a long time, everybody wanted bigger wines, darker wines, juicier wines. And now we
Parker
want
type wine.
Lighter wines, higher acid wines, right? Wines that represent something that is harder for winemakers to achieve because climate change gives us the opposite. Warmer weather gives us the opposite of that. And then I think it's just, you know, it's devastating. A vintage like 2021 in Burgundy where you have certain vineyards that are just demolished outright, 100%,
right.
75%.
Was that
gone.
Because of preseason?
Just extreme weather. Exactly. Extreme weather. And, you know, frost, hail, et cetera. Right. And
so how are some of these guys going to adopt?
I don't think you can. I think there's some
varietals plant higher up.
I don't know. I think we're just going to experience a change of it. I think Burgundy is just going to be a different place in 20 years. And we might be, we already are looking at like vintages of the past, having flavors and having
that winemaker nailed it.
Yeah.
Right? You're not going to see this again.
You know, you just don't see it again. And I think, you know, it's just wine just going to continue to taste different year over year. And for a long time, people are like, oh, they snubbed vintages like 2019, vintages like 2009, 2018, which are, you know, like dark, juicy, big wines. But the reality is like that, I don't think that's going anywhere. Now, yeah, 2009 doesn't taste the same way that 2010 does, right? And do I have a preference for one or the other?
Well,
for
that's
sure.
Vintage.
But like,
you know,
I do believe that we need to embrace the quality of wine every year. Of course, we can have favorites, but is to try to find, you know, some pleasure in the wine. If the fact is that the weather is going to continue to change around us, so our sensitivity should be informed by that.
It's funny how you said people who drink Meunier only champagne didn't realize, you know, that it wasn't a thing years ago, and orange wine where it came from. There's going to be a generation that's only drinking climate changed wines. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll be from 2003 on,
100%.
Which is an interesting thing.
Yeah, 100%.
All right, there's a lot of other you know, great chapters, specific wines, you know, like you said earlier, you know, you chose them. All right, before I let you leave, we're going to do the wine list, all right? You're going to answer 5 questions spontaneously. You're not going to dwell on them. I got to get out of here. I got to get you out of here. So the first question is, in your travels, because all you are around is wine people,
yep.
What are you drinking now? What's in your fridge? What are you curious about? What do you have to taste stuff for the restaurants? Seasonal changes? What are you drinking now? A few things.
What am I drinking right now? That's a great question. I am drinking a lot of champagne. I'm learning about sake.
Okay.
I'm drinking a lot of...
So champagne, I would assume, ramped up through the years where you drink champagne more and more. Sake you're adding because it's something you want to get better at in serving?
Yeah, and I just want to learn about it.
Okay.
Right? This is more like professional tasting stuff in terms of, hey, where are we getting presented with a lot of new, right? And I think those are, you know... those areas are really interesting. Because if I'm sitting down at dinner and drinking something for not as a professional, but just as a wine drinker and wine consumer, I'm quite staid in what I enjoy. So I tend to drink the same thing.
Okay.
Time and time again. Only because, you know, whatever, if I'm sitting down, I want to ensure that I really enjoy it.
No, I get that.
I leave the exploration.
Yeah, you get only so many shots. You want to do it right most of the time, right? Day.
So I hate to be like, I just, you know, try to drink a lot of Burgundy and go from there. But the wines that I think, you know, we're really seeing a lot of are, there's a ton of new champagne producers coming out. There's a few sake portfolios that are really exciting. And, you know, frankly, it's just something I know absolutely nothing about.
Well,
but
in time,
it's happening, and that's
and always Burgundy. All right, second question: goofiest one of the batch, favorite wine and food pairing. Not what you think a good one is, but what you like. And obviously, it's not something you eat that often.
What do I really love? Food and wine pairing.
We have a rule. You can't say champagne and oysters on this show.
No, that's fine. I really like, let's say...
what works?
Yeah, I think for me, crab leg shrimp cocktail and a lighter, younger style of white Burgundy is something I will always crave.
So nobody's ever given me that one.
Okay.
So I like that. All right. So crab legs.
Crab legs.
That's because you're a fancy guy.
Anything
I get that.
Crab. Oh, and yeah. Then, I mean, if you're.
Get specific here. Give me a producer or, you know, a region on the white Burgundy.
That makes sense for that. For that style. I think, you know, some of the kind of saltier style of white Burgundy and Chablis that's coming around. But. So say the white wines are Aligoté of Chantreve, for example, if you have that
great
with
producer.
A kind of umami laden crab dish, you're feeling really good about yourself. So.
What if you're not a big baller like you? Would Muscadet work with that?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Aligoté is not. Yeah,
I know. And I want people to realize Aligoté is one of the regions we talked about being sort of on the outskirts with great producers.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I didn't mention we post all these. You know, people like to hear what people who do this for a living are drinking. I'm sure you get out and about, but not as much because you get stuck here. But I want you to tell me favorite wine restaurant and or bars. And we talked about a bunch earlier.
Oh, man, it's hard to not just repeat.
But I want to say that you're not doing a ranked list. You're not doing a complete list. I just want you to throw out a few places that do it well. And if it's repetitive of what we said, fine. Because I don't want people coming up to you and saying, hey, I heard that podcast. How come you didn't mention me?
Oh, yeah.
Because the guy who interviewed you said you're not going to mention everyone. But who does it right? I'll say you do it right here.
Oh, thank you.
We talked about, you know, the food, the thought to the food. You know, you have a real chef. You know, the wine selection, the vibe, the knowledge. You know, if one of the people sitting here asks your people, hey, what's going on with this? They can answer that.
Yeah.
Who else is doing that?
Well, on Friday night, I went out with my girlfriend and two friends. And we tried to get into Four Horsemen and Claude. And we got a table at Claude, so we went to Claude. But if that's any testament, I think those are two, you know, for me, two of the most exciting restaurants. I think the food at the Nortwick is really exceptional, and a huge wine list there too.
That's
run by Cedric.
Cedric from 11
really,
Madison.
Really, really great. King is still, and these are all New York-centric places. King is still, you know, a go-to restaurant that I really, really
I
crave.
I like for a wine list.
And Gem, I think, you know, they just reopened I think Flynn is just someone who's, from a culinary perspective, is really on top of it right now and making really exceptional food. And there's usually a handful of producers that I don't know there more.
Which is the best, right?
Which is always fun. So you can try some stuff out there. But
all right. So say no more. Those are all good ones.
That's good. All right.
And that's not your ranked list. Those are just some of the things.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
You know, inevitably, they'll be New York because you spend most of the time here. And some are kind of neighborhoody. You know, some are far or whatever.
Yeah,
I mean location, not, you know, type. All right. Fourth question.
Yep.
Favorite all-time wine. When I first started asking this question to guys like Aldo Somme, I wanted to know, hey, what's the most expensive rare wine you ever tasted?
Oh, yeah.
Certainly, I don't care about that anymore. And everybody has. Okay. Here's what I care about. What is favorite all-time wine because of how it influenced you? Was it a gateway? It transcended you, changed the way you thought. Do you have a wine or two that's important
like
to you?
Like a specific producer?
Yeah.
Or, okay.
And time.
And
like I was at Froskin the first time I ever tasted, you know, wines from Friuli with stories like that were important.
Yeah, yeah. No, for sure. My favorite all-time wine. Well, there's so many like experiences that I don't even remember the producer, frankly, but
that's okay.
The first time I had like the pairing of, and I sound like just a snobby jerk here, but of white truffles and Barolo was at Frosca. They served,
you don't remember the Barolo?
I don't remember it. They just poured me something by the glass. But
was he?
That was
he
just
experimental
like,
and were carrying great producers that people didn't know of, or he had a line of the, you know, Vietti.
Always trying to. I think, you know, if there's great wine in Colorado, the team at Frosca is can take a lot of credit for bringing it there through their importer friends. That was great. And, you know, truthfully, like having the wines of Jean-Louis Chave continually, it's just such an impressive history. The people who run it today are exceptional.
Do you go to Northern Rhone? You said you
go
to Burgundy
at
the wrong
time. I've been lucky to go a couple times. But, you know, for me, there's just great.
Yeah.
Great.
No argument. No argument.
Wines there of many different vintages that I always, you know, find myself craving and have a lot of fond memories around drinking a good bottle of Chave.
Well, one is a producer that historically and recently you can't go wrong with vintages and, you know, different wines. The other is a region and a type of wine, Piedmont, the food, indigenous truffles, and the Barolo.
Yeah, so, I just think if you're like, hey, this is where, for me, the dots started
to
connect.
Those are good ones.
So.
Last question, and I want you to, if you can't answer this, no one can. Because this is zero straight up in your wheelhouse, okay? So you got to be good at this. The question is, I want you to recommend to me the best wine retail around 15, 20, 22 bucks. I want a red. I want a white.
In those specific categories or just in general?
Anything. Red, anything white. You can give me, like Muscadet, the right producer is a good value, right?
Okay.
That's like a tip off to an answer.
Okay.
But I want, because this is what you do retail. This is, you know, so my kids are in their late 20s. They can't go to a party with supermarket wine. They can't afford 45 bucks for a gift or a dinner.
Yep.
So how do you wow at 18, 20?
And for white and red?
Yep.
Okay. So wowing at 18 bucks.
20, 22.
That range.
Yeah.
I don't have to. Okay, cool. Yeah. I was like, that's a pretty tight window.
Well, that's why you got to figure this out.
Yeah, exactly. I think for me, the greatest value in wine right now is from Spain.
Okay.
I think the white wines from the northwestern part of Spain, so call it Albariño, Godello, are just really, really exceptional and of really like great value. And I think there's unique characteristics to the wines, but also they serve a purpose of just having a refreshing glass of white wine, which at, you know.
And thoughtful producers make a bunch of
them. Yeah, of course. You know, it's made well.
That wasn't hard.
I'm not sweating it. Yeah, okay. That was good.
Any other white suggestion? Or I could close the book on that one. Does anything else?
And then for me, my like favorite all-time inexpensive white is Fiano Diavolino from
Italy.
I think, you know, a handful of producers. But for me, that's if I see it on a wine list and even if I don't know the producer, chances are I'm going to always enjoy it. It's a little smoky. It's really refreshing. Same deal. So
good
cheap
ones.
Italian white and Spanish white. It's good.
Now jump to red.
Jump to red. Yeah. Red is.
Red's sometimes a little harder to get into that price range.
Red's harder to get into that price range. I do think that, again, in Spain, but also in the southern part of France, you know, for a long time, that was sort of like this ring of fire of kind of darker Grenache-based wines. But I think nowadays, you know, a lot of really good value is and quality is coming from there. We get presented with a lot of Grenache from Spain and also from, you know, southern part of France.
Yep.
So
and they
that
can be
gets
different.
Like, yeah, exactly. A little bit more producer specific. But I think, you know, for me, if there's wine from the southern part of France or from Spain and it's a red and look for lower alcohol, so call it, you know, 14% and under, I would bet on that. So
good ones. I like the varietal.
Cool.
All right, we're wrapping up the show. We're going to do this quickly.
Thank you so much. No.
We do a thing called the weekly wine sip. Every week we taste a different wine. Usually when I have a producer, it's fun to drink his wine.
Yeah.
When I'm at a restaurant or a retailer, what represents. So I said, Grant, pick a bottle of wine. Tell me what you picked.
I picked the 2019 Vietti Castiglione. All right, grab it. All right.
Why did you pick this wine?
Let me say that again. Why did you pick this wine?
I picked this wine because I think this is a wine made by a wonderful person. The winery has a long, long history of making great wine. And Italian wine was very much my gateway into wine. I lived in the larger region where Barolo is in Piemonte. So for me, Nebbiolo was, which is to get back a good value to look for Nebbiolo, really just an early wine that I was like, cool, I smell something in this. That's not just wine. It reminds me of a certain place. And I think for me, Vietti has just been one of the great winemakers in the Castiglione from them.
Castiglione is a vineyard select area?
Castiglione is a sub-region within Barolo.
Right.
This is a blend of many different single vineyards.
In Castiglione?
Exactly. Yep.
Do they own the vineyards or are
they
contract?
Own the vineyards. They own the vineyards.
These are all Vietti vineyards.
These are Vietti vineyards.
Mixed.
Yep.
Blended, I mean.
Farms, blended, et cetera. And Luca and Elena are just wonderful winemakers. The news is out that they are not involved in Vietti anymore. So I think that part of, you know, in writing the book is there's these periods of where wineries have their moment and then maybe they get sold off and things change from a quality perspective. I know that the wines will not be as great as
they going forward, they're out. I mean, not consulting or making.
I don't want to speak on yet, but it's out there.
Yeah,
people can read about it.
It's not, that's so it's,
I don't,
it's
I'm not trying to tell
this
story.
Things if going
yeah.
forward, it's
no,
not
no.
that.
I believe they're out going on to do something else. But the so that's all to say. I think Vietti of the 2019 and older
was 19 the cutoff year.
It's hard to say. I don't want to. I'm not a authority of what was going on there. But I would, you know, I think the wines are really
so just quickly
exceptional.
Barolo.
A style of Barolo that's easy to drink without
a lot of
age. The color
is, you know, kind of a purple translucent, right?
It's pretty dark in here too, so it's
What's the traditional nose descriptors in Barolo?
Black licorice, fresh raspberries, fresh strawberries, roses.
So red, rose, right.
Yeah, I think it's more about being floral and fruity aromatically, and maybe a little bit of like kind of spice to it. But then palate-wise, it is very like savory and bright, and
savory, bright. Do any of the nose descriptors carry into the palate?
Yeah, for sure. I would say on the palate, the fruit is maybe a little bit tartar and lighter than how it presents aromatically.
And the mouthfeel is always kind of a medium, right? It's never...
Yeah. I've had older bottles of Castiglione, but I think for me it's a wine that drinks well young now, so it's not like painfully tannic. Right. It's pretty...
Does that vary vintage by vintage?
For sure. Tannins are really affected by...
Yeah.
By heat.
Yeah. All right, so that's the 2019
Castiglione.
You serve that here?
We do, yeah.
By the glass or bottle?
We have it by the glass right now.
Okay. Yeah. All right, we got to wrap up, Grant.
Thank you.
Got to get you out of here.
I appreciate it.
Let me do a quick wrap up. I want to get some info and we're out of here in a minute. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your pods. Leave a review if you're enjoying the podcast. You can follow us on Instagram @sbenruby and on Twitter @benruby, two different handles. But you can always find us with the hashtag The Grape Nation. We're on Facebook at The Grape Nation. As I mentioned, we will post Grant's wine list answers, some good recos there, and I'll do a recap of the wine we tasted. Grant, where's the best place to find more info on Parcel?
Parcelwine.com.
Make a reservation down here. What do we do?
Parcelwine.com. You can find out about the wine bar, see some of the inventory that we have available for delivery, read a little bit.
What about social media handles?
We're at Parcel Wine. I'm
PARCELLEWINE. Okay.
Yep. And I'm personally not active on social media.
Is that the store and the restaurant?
That's everything.
Okay.
Yep.
And then the site?
It's parcelwine.com.
Okay. All right. I want to thank Grant Reynolds for talking about the book, which is interesting. Where can we get the book?
You can get it.
Go to your local bookseller.
Yeah.
If you can't go there, where else? Amazon?
Don't get it. Barnes & Noble and Amazon.
Okay. So that's where you can get the book. Thank you to Grant Reynolds. Thank you to our engineer, Armin, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Benruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.